Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday the 25th of August 2021 and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop. I'm David Taylor and he's Phil Bishop. Morning, Phil.
Morning, David.
How are you doing?
I'm very well. I'm doing very well indeed. How are you doing?
I'm very well too. Well, that's good, isn't it? We've got off to a good start. Got quite a lot to discuss this week. There have been a few changes, haven't there, in the industry?
Well, the first thing we're going to discuss is a, to my mind, utterly meaningless piece of cosmetic. It's not even surgery. It's not even Botox. It's Highways England, for some reason, is changing its name, or has changed its name already, to National Highways.
Yeah.
In the words of Edmund King, the president of the AA, this is a bizarre move. And I kind of agree with him. What do you reckon to it?
No, me too. I just cannot see the thinking behind it. It seems pointless. I mean, I noticed that you reported it on the website, I think yesterday or maybe the day before, and your opening gambit was that they're going to have...
No, this is back end of last week.
Was it? Okay, fine.
Yeah.
But you mentioned they're going to have to change all their stationery, which of course is a necessary thing when you change your identity. It seems totally pointless because, I mean, Highways England... I mean, before Highways England, of course, it was the Highways Agency. Then they changed to Highways England, which I could sort of understand on the basis that it was in charge of the road network in England, but not in Wales or Scotland or Northern Ireland. But to change it to National Highways seems to just have the opposite of effect of clarifying things. It seems pointless.
Well, as you say, it's a subnational organisation. It is mm-hmm. not a national organisation. It's only looking after the roads of England and only some roads in England, not yeah. all of them. You know, it's just the motorways and trunk roads, what they call yeah. the strategic road network. National, as a word, I find slightly pejorative. I always think of, National Trust, I feel warm yeah. towards, but an awful lot of words with national in there. In their title, whether it's National Front or whatever,
yeah, you know, it's nothing like that.
It's a little bit sort of brown shirty, isn't it?
I suppose so. I mean, I'm a bit more relaxed about the use of the word national. Well, I know that it tends to be attached to, nationalism is a.
Yes.
Disapprove fundamentally of nationalism, actually. But I just don't understand why they needed to do it. And as far as I can tell, they haven't even volunteered any explanation for this, have they?
It doesn't satisfy me as an explanation. But what they say in the official statement that the Department for Transport or Highways England put out, National Highways, we must now call them, they say. It's the name change heralds a new era for strategic roads. This reflects the new focus the company has on delivering the government's strategic roads investment programme, while also continuing to set highway standards for the whole UK. So I think here's the thing, is that, yes, it only looks after the roads in England, mm-hmm. but it does seem to have some sort of nationwide role for setting standards, you know, for what materials are used and so on. And they've even managed to shoehorn the phrase levelling up into this announcement. The strategic road network plays a key role in levelling up by connecting places, connecting England's regions, ports and international trade corridors. There's no change in the organisation's role and what it does, even though it says it's the start of a new era. It's only the sense of a new era in that there's the guy who's been in interim charge for the past 6-8 months is now being given the job officially. Nick Harris is now the new chief executive. Why they couldn't appoint him? I mean, the previous bloke handed in his notice yonks before he actually retired, so they had masses of time to do the recruitment process. When the previous bloke finally went, Jim O'Sullivan, finally went in February after completing 6 months' notice, they could only manage to give Nick Harris the job on an interim basis. And that was in January. And now, August, 8 months later, they go, yeah, okay, you can have the job now.
Yeah. That tends to happen, though, doesn't it?
Well, it's stupid.
It's stupid.
I mean, apart from anything else, unless he's been given the nod and the wink, I don't think it's fair on the man himself, to be honest.
No, that's true. And I wonder if he had any say in the name change. I wonder if it was his way of putting his stamp on the organisation, change its name. So this is my outfit now.
Could be part of the deal, the recruitment negotiating process. Things I've read suggested it came from above, from the Department for Transport, but I have no.
I think that's more likely. To be honest,
that's the case. I don't know. It just seems. It seems, as the man said, bizarre to me.
Maybe it's their way of trying to dodge all the flack from the desecration of the historic rail estate that they've been filling in and knocking down. Recently, we talked about this before, so I won't go into it again. But it did make my blood boil when I saw what they were doing to these old rail bridges. I have to say that Highways England, or National Highways as they now are, not my favourite organisation at the moment.
Well, there is there's an opening for a conspiracy theory here, of course, that maybe it's a push for national control of the nation's strategic road network. If you remember, the Welsh devolved government abandoned plans to extend the M4 across South Wales a year or two ago. I can't remember exactly when that was. And so there might be people in Highways England thinking, oh, those Welsh people are, you know, obviously can't be trusted with their own roads. If we took them over, things would be much better. And then Scotland is now currently big story in Scotland is the A9 dualling, amongst other road building projects, but that's the big one up in the north, is under threat because the SNP have got into bed with the Green Party in Scotland.
Yeah.
The Greens have now got a couple of seats in the devolved government in Scotland. And part of the marriage contract seems to be that the Greens are going to be, I don't know whether they'll be able to cancel the roads, but they've certainly got a different take on road building from the SNP.
Yeah, they want to, don't they? I mean, the SNP declared a climate emergency not so long ago, and a lot of the Greens and various environmental groups immediately stood up and said, well, why are you going to be dualling this road and increasing the road traffic across the Highlands? And they thought, oh, yes. And I think I can't remember the phrase that the roads minister used, but he basically said, oh, this is up for debate or something. This is, this isn't a done deal. And that provoked a bit of an outcry from the Highlands and Islands Council and various other bodies which are going to benefit, which would benefit by improved road links up in that rather remote part of Scotland. So, I think the SNP have really got to get their act together because they're giving mixed messages at the moment.
Well, maybe National Highways will sort out these national issues that affect the UK.
Yeah,
on the subject of the A9 dualling, it's worth getting sort of back firmly onto topic of Construction Weekly News, that the contract notice for the £150 million stretch between Moy and, I don't know how you pronounce this place, Tomatin, I don't know, let's call the whole thing off. no, let's not call the building off, let's call the tomato bit off.
Yeah.
So it's 20 miles of dual carriageway south of Inverness. Is the contract, you know, the procurement is moving forward. Now, whether it actually ends up being built is more in doubt today than it was a month ago, I suggest. But I don't think National Highways will have control of the national network for a while yet, if at all.
No, I shouldn't think so. I should think the devolved governments would have something to say about that for a start. And you can't really put devolution into reverse. At least I think it would create a lot of problems if you tried.
Although maybe once Scotland goes its own way and Wales looks at it and thinks, oh, that's not a bad idea. And, you know, Johnson's already seems to have lost interest in Northern Ireland. So Highways England will be a national organisation. The whole country of England will be covered.
Yeah, possibly. Any other changes to note this week? Anything that we should change in our address books?
Well, this is a story which you and I were talking about putting this on our agenda for last week, but we were fully immersed in hydrogen last week, and we had no time to talk about anything but hydrogen in that packed programme. But this is a week old story that. Geoffrey Osborne, they seem to have dropped the Geoffrey, so as not to be confused with the soul singer, but Osborne, the construction company, have somewhat surprisingly, to my mind, agreed the sale of their infrastructure, civil engineering arm.
Yeah.
When this announcement first landed in my in-tray, I thought, that's interesting. Someone getting out of infrastructure and civil engineering, because it's not gone unnoticed that in the past year or so, a lot of companies who are more focused on building work traditionally as their market, and I'm thinking of Sir Robert McAlpine and Mace in this regard, have built up their capacity, capability and presence in civil engineering, whether it's for road or rail or water or whatever. I think Mace are now on road building network frameworks, I think. McAlpine is certainly moving into this space in a big way. And therefore, for Osborne to decide to move in the opposite direction, I thought, hello, what's going on here then? And I said, look, you've got to tell me more, because the way you've put it out, this bald announcement, that especially as when someone sells something to private equity as well, it always makes me think, oh, blimey.
Yeah.
And so it's a private equity sale. It's not someone who's already in the game had it been McAlpine buying Osborne's infrastructure division or something, I could see what was going on there. That all sort of would be clear. But for Osborne to walk away from civil engineering work when that's where the direction that the market seems to be going in at the moment.
It's a big part of their business as well, isn't it? Civil engineering is something. Is it about 40% something?
I was going to say a third. It could be 30-40%, something like that. Yes, and profitable. It's not like it's a lot of their turnover and they're losing money on it. They make money on it, and it transpires on further investigation. This is not a fire sale or a company in trouble that sort of thought, oh, we need to sell something off at all. That actually, this is a long gestating plan. It was several years ago, back in 2016, that they announced the plan to separate it out from the business. And they didn't say at the time that this was with a view to a future sale, but it now becomes apparent that setting up Osborne Infrastructure Limited was paving the way for either a disposal or a hiving off of more complete hiving off. And this is what's now happened. So it's just, working it through.
Yeah. But what's the thinking? I found it a bit puzzling as well when I first heard about it, because I always thought of Osborne as being very much into civil engineering. I mean, I know they were sort of a general contract. They did a lot of building work as well, but I always thought of them primarily as a civil engineering contractor. But looking further into their business now, I mean, having a look at their website, in other words, they're very much focused on modern methods of construction, off-site manufacturing. They've got this division called Innovari Systems, which make SIPs, isn't it? The sort of the panel systems, and they're talking about net zero carbon and all the rest of it, and focusing on things like the private rental sector and I think student accommodation, something like that. Not sectors which I would have expected them to, but maybe that's because of my preconceptions about the company. It seemed strange. It seemed as if they were ditching their core business in order to pursue something which is a little bit new, certainly taking a new direction, I would have thought.
Well, we talked a couple of weeks ago, didn't we, about the huge costs involved in getting into building systems, off-site,
yeah,
modern methods, and all of this. And we talked about the volumetric house builders, I think, mostly. What we didn't mention when we were talking about off-site startup costs a couple of weeks ago was the amount of money that Lang O'Rourke have sunk into their factory I think it's in Steakley, is it? But somewhere, I think it's somewhere in the Midlands.
Oh, right.
That cost them an awful lot more than they had hoped it was going to, and took an awful, you know, took a lot to get that up and going.
Yeah.
And I think Osborne are, I'm speculating merely, but if everyone else is finding it expensive, I'm sure Inivari has proved quite a commitment for Osborne. So maybe there was an element of putting, if not all, more of their eggs in the off-site basket.
I don't know. One thing it just occurred to me, actually, as you mentioned that, did they launch Inivari or did they acquire it? Was it already, I mean, did they shoulder the initial investment in the creation of the company, or did they buy it as a going concern?
Well, I'm going to Google that because I thought they'd launched it, but I can't.
Well, you might
remember.
Be right. What I'm saying is I don't know. I mean, I was aware of Inivari and I'd never really linked it to Osborne. I don't think they made a big deal of being part of the Osborne group. If they did, then I missed that. But I was vaguely aware of them, but didn't really know that they were part of Osborne. I was quite surprised to find out that this is the business, one of the business sectors they want to focus on now. And the other thing which surprised me was that Osborne has a development arm. You know, they talk about doing everything from sort of design, development, procurement, and all the way through building these projects. So, you know, property development is part of their business now as well, which surprised me because I didn't think of them as being property developers.
So to answer your question on Inivari, it's a much older company than I had any idea of. It's incorporated in 2005 in Inivari Systems by Osborne. It was an Osborne startup in 2005.
Well, obviously they've pinned their colours to that particular mast, then, and they're committed, so they're going to follow that route. I can see if that's the way that they see the industry going. And maybe, I don't know, the infrastructure sector is going to become more crowded with more tier one contractors like Mace and McAlpine moving in there. Maybe they want to refocus on something where they're not going to be coming up against those big boys.
Well, I suppose if they're taking the long view, just because civil engineering, I mean, we know that the building market and the civil engineering market operate on different cycles.
Hmm.
So just because civil engineering is hot right now, who's to say that, you know, more of HS2 won't get cancelled or stalled and suddenly everyone goes cold on infrastructure and civil engineering. And just looking in Inivari's numbers while we're talking, it only turned over 13 million in 2019, 10 million the year before that. So compared to Osborne Infrastructure, Inivari is very small beer indeed.
Yeah.
But interesting. Anyway, Osborne Infrastructure Limited, which goes by the probably politically incorrect acronym these days.
Yeah.
Oil.
Yeah.
Maybe it should change its name from oil to wind.
Yeah, precisely. Yes, but they need to reverse engineer their acronym. I wonder what that would come up with. You mentioned the company, I can't remember the name, the company that Osborne sold this business to, and the fact that it's a venture capitalist, it's not another civil engineering contractor, which, as you rightly pointed out, would make a lot of sense. Any idea why they've sold it to a venture capitalist? I mean, they said in their sort of explanation to this, because you had a conversation with an email conversation with Richard King, the marketing director at Osborne, and copied me in very kindly, and he made the point that yes, it's Sullivan Street is the organisation that has buying the business. And he says that we have a strong cultural fit with Sullivan Street Partners, and we are certain that they will support the infrastructure business to grow and prosper into an even greater business. I don't know how close a cultural fit can a civil engineering contractor have with a venture capitalist. I mean, surely only on the financial side of things.
Well, I do tend to take a slightly negative attitude towards the whole private equity business. But they aren't, despite that, I do recognise that they're not all asset strippers, slash and burners, tear things apart and bleed them dry. And you know, that has been the model for some in the past. A lot of private equity firms are in the business of taking a company that works but could work better with a bit of investment and care, and building it up and then selling it on. I mean, they're never in it for the long game, private equity companies.
No.
They want to grow the business and sell it for more than they bought it for. We don't know what they bought it for.
Do you know anything about Sullivan Street? I'd never heard of them before.
Not a lot. I looked them up. They're not, by private equity terms, they're not, you know, KKR. They're not about to buy Morrison's or, you know, in that sort of league. But Morrison's a supermarket, I mean, in this context, not the former Scottish construction company. But I think I thought they had maybe a dozen interests, and one of which was, I can't remember exactly what, but was marginally related to construction. But there's nothing that particularly fits with Osborne. Or Osborne Infrastructure Limited. It would be a, you know, a standalone thing. But I think that for Osborne selling to this particular outfit, to Sullivan Street, what it does, I suspect, is protect the people at Osborne. If I mentioned, you know, if Mace or McAlpine were wanting to beef up their civil engineering arm, Osborne Infrastructure Limited might have been a good acquisition for them to get onto framework lists and so on. But that would have probably meant them putting in their own people at the top of the organisation, merging back office functions, and there'd be job losses and so on. Whereas hiving off Osborne Infrastructure Limited as a standalone new entity on its own, it starts life with the same culture, structure and people that it had under Osborne. And for the people, and remember that Osborne is a family company, and therefore family companies generally seem to have a greater sense of their people, a greater affinity for their people than more hard-nosed commercial operations. I can see that they might have seen that this, as I say, while private equity is often not particularly sympathetic or associated with looking after people, in this case, I can see how it could be seen that way.
Yeah, I suppose it keeps it together as a separate unit. I mean, when Richard King talks about having a strong cultural fit with Sullivan Street, I think that probably means that Sullivan Street's culture doesn't impinge upon Osborne's in this case, and that Osborne remains.
That's more to it, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. And so Osborne remains sort of
gets to keep its own culture.
Unsullied. Yeah, as you rightly say, if they'd been bought by another civil engineering contractor, there would be a strong tendency for them to go in there and turn it into one of their own businesses very quickly. So yeah, well, I suppose that makes sense. If, as they say, they've been planning this for 4 or 5 years, then I suppose that might be part of the equation.
Well, talking of people,
yes,
who work for and within organisations, there is a very interesting survey going on right now until the 7th of September. So you've only got a couple of weeks or so to check it out, but do check it out if you employ people. The Construction Leadership Council is developing proposals to introduce a common set of metrics for measuring equality, diversity and inclusion in the construction industry. I'm obviously aware of the benefits of it, of equality, diversity and inclusion, and I think it's universally acknowledged to be a good thing, even if there are differing views on how best to manage, implement, monitor, and so on, equality, diversity and inclusion. I mean, one of the reasons why it's a good thing is because it's actually the law to respect different groups within societal groups within the workplace. And I looked at what the metrics are. There are nine protected characteristics. And we think of diversity as being predominantly, I suppose, about ethnicity, sexual orientation, and gender. But it's more than that. It's age, disability, gender reassignment, marriage and civil partnership, pregnancy and maternity, race, religion or belief, sex, and sexual orientation. But these are called protected characteristics by law. You cannot discriminate against someone because of these things. Now, whether you're allowed to discriminate with someone because they wear flared trousers or have got a bald head or not, I don't know. I would have thought that's unreasonable behaviour too, but they are not listed as protected characteristics.
I suppose the list of protected characteristics could be endless if you wanted to drill down that deeply into the details. I mean, I looked at the Construction Leadership Council survey. It's available online. It's a Survey Monkey questionnaire. It asks about, I think, only seven of those, which are sex, gender identity, age, religion or belief, ethnicity, disability and sexual orientation. And the one which I think is probably opens the door to all sorts of different things is religion or belief. Because religions, most people recognise religions and, we know what the main ones are and most people are aware of some of the more fringe religions. But belief, I think, is a much more open term, a much vaguer term.
It brings in political belief, doesn't it? Hear people being... So academics have lost their jobs for having the wrong political beliefs, for example.
And it opens the door to things like your moral values as well. These are my beliefs. Like, for example, there have been some celebrated cases about bakers not baking a gay wedding cake or whatever it was. That sort of thing, because it was against their religious beliefs. But I think there have been some sort of some examples of people's secular beliefs being tried in the courts, and to be perfectly honest, I can't remember whether or not people's secular beliefs are being upheld. But I mean, there's a suggestion that they should be. I mean, I think. Sorry, I don't know if I've hijacked the conversation because I think you're about to make a point, but you might have to come back to that. I felt reading this that either it's very, very simple or it's hopelessly complicated. In other words, either you accept people for what they are, or you have to argue the toss about everything that they are, if you know what I mean. If you take the latter route, then, it's chaos. I think most normal people would say that unless, for example, your beliefs are so at variance to most commonly held beliefs, that's not a problem. You accept them and you carry on. I mean, if your beliefs start to impinge upon your performance or affect other people, then that might be a problem.
As soon as you start stamping a label on someone, you run the risk of ceasing to be inclusive. That's Tommy the Scientologist who sits at that desk, and you can't get you can't call him Tommy the Scientologist. Well, that's what he is. He's Tommy the Scientologist. Yeah. But no, that would not be an inclusive behaviour.
No.
While diversity and inclusivity are regarded as something to aspire to, the question that the Construction Leadership Council is trying to drill down is how you not measure it in terms of give it a score, but how do you know what you're judging it against, what it looks like. And for the government as a whole, I think they say that a diverse workforce is one that represents the composition of society as a whole.
Yeah.
So if society as a whole is, whatever it may be, 10% homosexual, if your workforce is either all homosexual or has got no homosexuals in it, you're somehow not reflecting the makeup, the composition of society as a whole. But even that is more complicated than it can at first seem, because if we talk about ethnicity, for example, a company in East London or Bradford or parts of the country with a high ethnic minority composition, mm-hmm. what would constitute a diverse workforce in one part of the country would mm-hmm. look different in another part of the country.
That's a good point.
It would be reasonable for a Bradford company, for example, to have a much higher people of Pakistani origin people working mm-hmm. for them mm-hmm. than a company in Taunton or Penzance, for example.
Yeah.
So you need to, just by saying, the way you measure diversity is you have to say, right, X percent of your workforce ought to look like this or ought to, you know, comprise mm. that. And even that isn't necessarily adequate, because something else I was reading is saying what's more relevant is, I mean, yes, you need to look at what society looks like around you, but also you need to look at who's applying for the jobs.
Mm.
And on the one hand, you should be asking yourselves questions. I mean, no one's saying you have to, you know, fulfill quotas. That's not what it's about. It's saying that if your workforce doesn't represent the wider society, the composition of the wider society, might you be doing something wrong? Whether it's in your job adverts, whether it's in your recruitment process,
yeah.
whether it's in your how you manage people, that, you know, maybe a certain type of person is not made to feel included in your place of work. And as well, construction historically has had awful difficulties with A, recruiting, and B, making them feel equal, included and worthwhile. And a lot of the top companies have been doing an awful lot of work on this, but it remains work in progress.
Yeah, I mean, for as long as I've been writing about construction, there's been a debate about the disproportionately small number of ethnic minorities and women in construction, and that's still the case very largely.
There does seem to be a big rise in female plant operators and crane operators.
Sure, yeah.
And partly it's visibility. If you can, it's easier to be what you can see, kind of thing. And mm-hmm. Certain high, in social media terms, in the industry, high profile women operators who are mm-hmm. Flying the flag. But also more practically, go back to pre-hydraulic days when NCK great big shovel cranes were mechanical levers. You had to be a certain type of build,
a certain build.
To be able to pull the levers.
Yeah.
and now it's all PlayStations and Xbox type, you know, joysticks and fingertip control, and anyone who is dexterous and hand-eye coordination, whatever. It's not a physical thing like it used to be.
I mean, I can think of a couple of examples of what I would consider to, I mean, examples of organisations or sites which might be worth debating about their inclusivity. One is, I remember visiting a road construction project and happened to notice that nearly every single person working on the paving, asphalt paving, was a Sikh. And somebody said to me, yeah, Sikhs are great at paving. Now, I thought, are they trying to suggest that there's some sort of racial predisposition amongst Sikhs that they are particularly good at laying asphalt? I don't think so. I think there was something else going on there. But no, he said, no, look, you get a lot of Sikhs in the paving industry.
Well, it might have been that firm. I remember, I think it was earlier this year. It may have been last year. I can't remember the context. What caught my eye was a heavily predominantly Sikh firm was on a diversity drive.
Oh,
and,
right.
I mean, to you and I, sort of white, middle-aged Anglo-Saxons, we would think of diversity as employing, you know, more people who might not look like us. And that's exactly what they were doing. They wanted to employ more people who didn't look like them. They wanted to, you know, move away from this heavy preponderance of employing amongst from their own group.
Well, yeah, that's diversity just as much as
of course
looking at it from the other the other end of the telescope. And another business, I wrote a piece a few years ago now about a building firm, I think in the London area, where the boss, the chap who actually launched the business, the boss, and I think a majority of his staff were all profoundly deaf. And that was very interesting because...
You wrote about this in the magazine, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Yeah, that's right. And it was interesting to look at that because, of course, if somebody who's profoundly deaf goes, wants to get a job as a construction worker, a prospective employer might balk at that because they can immediately think of the health and safety ramifications of this person can't hear the digger that is approaching them rapidly from behind, or can't hear a warning shouted to them by somebody else. And indeed, this is partly why the managing director of this firm had favoured deaf people, not only because he had experienced the discrimination, despite having got his MVQs and qualified and was perfectly capable of doing the job. He couldn't get a job with a normal contractor because of his disability. So he started his own business and hired people with the same disability as himself because he knew from personal experience that they were capable. But also there was the fact that people who are profoundly deaf modify their behaviour in order to accommodate that. So they are more aware of their surroundings. Other people rely on their hearing to warn them of things. Deaf people can't do that, so they find other ways of making sure they know what's going on around them. And because everybody was in the same boat, if you like, it created a very safe environment. But again, that's would, if they were to develop some sort of metric to measure diversity, would a site where 60% of the people on it are all profoundly deaf, would that qualify as a suitably diverse environment? I mean, strictly speaking, it's not, is it?
Well, no. But equally, if you're measuring, and the official guidance does say measuring diversity can be challenging, as the characteristics mentioned, values, beliefs, knowledge and skills, can be hard to define, and when you're analysing the data, it's not always clear what the appropriate level of diversity is or should be, i.e. Mm. what society you're measuring it against, whether it's your town or your country or whatever. But it's not just one. Your organisation where everyone or vast majority of people share the same disability, it also needs to, or is best advised to, be diverse in other aspects of religion and mm-hmm. gender and yeah. ethnicity and so on. So it's a complicated matrix. And this is what the Construction Leadership Council doing this survey to come up with how best to measure and monitor diversity and inclusivity and equality. Because companies want to be able to see how they're doing. Are we doing it right? And they want to be able to benchmark themselves. And if all the construction companies are able to say, right, this is standard practice, and it's like so many of these things, it's as much art as science. But if we have the same toolbox for saying how do we assess what diversity and inclusivity should look like, then we know whether we're falling behind our peers what we should be doing about it.
Yeah. The questionnaire, I notice, also asks about potential barriers to creating this metric and actually gathering the information. And I can't remember exactly what the questions are, but I mean, it asks about things like confidentiality, for example. Some people might not want to disclose their sexual orientation, for example. I mean, they might say, what's it got to do with
none of your business?
This is what I do at home. Thank you very much. And other people might not want to discuss their ethnic background or any other of these sort of distinguishing features. And other people might think, And this is natural. People think about it all the time. We're always being asked these questions. And your first thought is, well, why do they want this information? What are they going to do with it? Who's going to have access to it? So there might be some pushback from the industry itself in terms of complying with this. If a company were to include or to start asking questions like this, you might find a lot of people just say, no, I'm not telling you, you know, so forget it. So I think it's something which certainly the industry and a lot of, you know, a large majority of the population would probably think is a good thing. And yet when it comes down to brass tacks, you might find it's actually difficult to obtain the information you need in order to measure these things, you know, because people just don't want to know. And, you know, a lot of people might also say, oh, this is just woke politics, you know, because, you know, it's Black Lives Matter and LGBTQ plus, you know, getting in the way of, because there are plenty of people out there who have got no time for this sort of thing. And unfortunately, you know, the construction industry is frequently accused of being old-fashioned in its outlook and in its practices. And there certainly is a large minority of people out there who take that sort of approach. So you might find a lot of resistance coming from that.
But also, I think we've got to remember that most construction companies are very small businesses. They might only have, you know, 10 or 20 employees, where it's much harder to have a workforce that mirrors the diverse makeup of society as a whole. If you've got 5,000 employees and you've got a big HR department and so on and so forth, you'll have systems in place, and it's just more likely that you'll have more different types in there, which will make other more different types more comfortable in there.
Yeah.
If you've got 20 people and they've worked for you for 10 years and someone leaves, like as not, the person who joins will be the guy who's left son, for example, or daughter, perhaps. You know, it's the first person who you know who comes along or you make from another company. I mean, it's in small businesses, that's they just work in different ways.
Yeah.
But what I would say is, while I think achieving diversity and measuring it, monitoring it, measuring and monitoring any of these things is hard, but achieving diversity, I think, is something to aspire to. But I'm not sure that I am as bothered by it in terms of absolutely achieving it as by inclusivity and equality. I think, you know, we talk about EDI, and the E and the I seem to me more important.
Yes.
You don't have to be, you know, woke or quota driven or anything to take equality and inclusion as common sense, good manners,
exactly.
Human decency. Treat everyone as an individual with respect and without putting a label on them.
I notice also that diversity training, which of course will go hand in hand with this, people will need training in diversity or EDI. It's big business because McKinsey, you know, the consultant,
management consultants,
they calculate that in the United States, $8 billion is spent every year on diversity training, which is huge. That is huge, isn't it? I don't know what the figure is in the UK. Obviously, a lot less than that, but it's something which attracts an awful lot of investment and time and effort.
Just to recap on that, the survey you can find by going to the Construction Leadership Council website and follow the links to the EDI survey, and that is open until the 7th of September. The more input, the better for all of us, really, everyone concerned. And
it's quite a small questionnaire. It won't take you very long. I mean, it's a couple of pages, and easy to answer.
The outcome will be the EDI measuring and monitoring system, planned for introduction by the end of next year, by the end of 2022. Mm-hmm. The Leadership Council says, all being well.
So, are we done for the week then, Phil?
I think we are. I think that wraps it up. Very conscious, David, that when people like you and I try and talk about equality, diversity and inclusivity, we are, as mentioned before, we're not the most qualified in this subject. So if we have offended, please don't cancel us and we apologise in advance. But thank you very much, everyone, for listening once again. But from David and myself, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.